Right, my phone is going off. You can't hear that, can you? Hi, hello, my name's Juliet Davenport and welcome to Great Green Questions. Right now I'm actually in my office, which is a little dull, looking outside and hoping to get out there soon because it is one of the few very warm spring days. And I see it, everything bursting into spring right now. It makes me very excited to think about what's going to be coming up in my garden in the next few months. In fact, the food is essential to all of our lives on this amazing planet. And on this planet, we have 7 billion human inhabitants. Over 1 billion have only limited access to food and spend their days wondering if today is the day they will get a meal, while another billion throw nearly 50% of their food in the bin uneaten. In fact, the scale of food waste in our world is mammoth. On a global level, 30% of food we produce is wasted. A third of the UK fruit and veg is rejected for being the wrong size or the wrong shape before it even reaches the supermarket shelf. And that's not even looking at the cost of emissions. In fact, one third of greenhouse gas emissions globally come from agriculture, and 30% of the food we produce is wasted, about 1.8 billion tonnes of it a year. It has been said that if we, as a planet, stop wasting food altogether, we'd eliminate 8% of our total emissions. But how do we do this? And what would it look like if we did? If you hadn't guessed already, today's great green question is, are we throwing away our future with our food? My panel today is Melissa Hemsley, self-taught chef, best-selling cookbook author. Melissa is a waste warrior, a champion for fair trade and food sustainability. Her most recent book is called Eat Green, and it's full of fantastic flexitarian recipes for planet-friendly eating. Our next guest is Ed Gillespie, a great friend of mine, an environmental entrepreneur, speaker, writer, and futurist. Well, witty futurist, to be honest. Ed trained as a marine biologist before making a career in sustainable working and businesses, and organisations including Zero Carbon Food, Greenpeace, and Panda Packaging. Ed co-hosts not one but two podcasts of his own, The Great Humbling and The Future Noughts with comedian John Richardson. My third guest is Carolyn Steele, an architect who writes about food. Carolyn is the author of the award-winning Hungry City, How Food Shapes Our Lives, and Zootopia, How Food Can Save the World. Carolyn's global TED Talk has been viewed by over a million people, where she talks about how food and how we live come together. Since all living things must eat, food is a powerful force for shaping our bodies, habits, homes, cities, landscapes, and climate. So food is a pretty powerful thing. It affects everything around us. And we discussed this in the episode, but we also tackled what are the potential threats for not addressing food waste? Corporate sustainability versus the responsibility of the individual. Food literacy and the fact that so much of what we are talking about relies on people knowing their way around a well-stocked kitchen. Practical tips for reducing food waste at home, including some of Melissa's delicious recipes. And a surprising turn of events for the humble and ever-binned banana peel and the many, many uses of the cauliflower stem. I really enjoyed this episode. I had great fun and it was really interesting finding about new ideas and new ways of thinking about food. I hope you enjoy it. I certainly had lots of fun, brilliant characters and great opinions coming through. And remember, if you have your own great green question, then please feel free to message me on Twitter at DavenportJuliet or write it in the comments of this podcast. We'll check them out and see whether we can cover them in a future episode. Until then, enjoy the show.
Actually thought the other day, I probably think about food more often than the average 15-year-old boy thinks about sex. You know, seriously. I mean, it's like every minute or so. Whether it's what I just ate, or what I'm going to eat next, or what I'm going to have for dinner, or indeed, you know, given the subject of this podcast, what I'm going to do with my leftovers. I mean, it's just absolutely ongoing, obsessive, never-ending, and one of the great sources of, well, the greatest source of joy in my life.
Hi, and welcome to Great Green Questions. A lot of people can feel guilty for not being a perfect environmentalist. So I'm going to kick off with my confession today around food and food waste. So I'm an environmentalist, but The food waste in my house gets eaten by our animals, actually. So the scraps go to the dogs and anything else tends to go to our chickens. But we have various vegans and veggies in the family. And as a result, we seem to end up with a lot of plastic because a lot of those products tend to come in plastic, things like corn and everything. So that is my confession as an environmentalist. I definitely produce too much waste when we eat veggie in the house. But when we think of food waste, we always think of it at a household level. So I'm just kind of talking about it personally. But actually, it's an absolute huge problem from climate change. And if food waste was a country, it would be the third biggest emitter of greenhouse gases after the US and China. So our big question today is, are we throwing our future away with our food? I have a fantastic panel today to discuss this, and I'm going to ask you all to introduce yourself, starting off first with Melissa.
Hi, everybody. I'm Melissa Hemsley, and I like to share kitchen tips and tricks for both unconfident cooks, or maybe those that don't identify as cooks, as well as with people that love food but would like to be a little bit greener in the kitchen, whether it is embracing more whole foods or whether it is cutting right back on meat, dairy, fish. And I'm a huge fan of the food waste ever-growing movement. In my house, it wasn't really talked about as food waste. I've got a Filipino Catholic mother and army father. It was just a sin. It was like the biggest of the big sins. And it is super satisfying when you feel like you sort of beat the system and got a lovely dinner out of nothing.
Brilliant. And environmental confession.
The one thing I'm mostly ashamed of is last summer I bought a small aircon unit because I absolutely couldn't work or speak for about a week in the heat of summer. And I feel deeply guilty about that. And so much so that I'm actually hoping or thinking I'm going to have to move because it's only getting warmer. And when it's really hot, my house is a greenhouse, despite all the top 20 things one should do good energy wise to reduce it. So I feel very sad about that. That's my big confession.
Okay, so confession, moving north maybe to the Arctic Circle, yeah, to get a little cooler.
And maybe cutting my hair off and shaving my entire body to stop.
Now that is quite radical.
I mean, Ed's got a beard. I wouldn't be able to have a beard.
Yeah. So that brings us nicely to Ed. Ed, can you introduce yourself, please?
My name's Ed Gillespie. I'm representing that repressed minority of white, middle-aged, middle-class men. I'm a director of Greenpeace UK. I'm a recovering sustainability consultant. I used to call my style of consultancy insultancy, being strategically rude to clients to try and get them to raise their aspirations. I co-present a couple of podcasts, The Great Humbling with Dougal Hine, John Richardson, The Future Noughts, How to Survive the Future. I like to describe myself as the grit in the sustainability oyster that might hopefully become the pearl.
And what is your relationship to food, Ed?
Oh, my relationship to food. Well, if food was a dating app, I'd be on all of them.
Swiping right. I mean,
obviously, it's the most fun you can have with your clothes on and the second most sensual experience we can have. But yeah, I'm passionate, saucy, celebratory, occasionally indulgent. But obviously, it's a complex relationship, which has consequences. So if you go at your relationship with food with wild, promiscuous abandon, you get into trouble.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's complex.
And what is your environmental confession?
Oh, my environmental confession. I do still eat the very occasional steak.
Right, okay.
I have to say, I am primarily plant-based. There's no justification for it. I do obviously go for ethical grass-fed cows, which have generally had a good life, but there's no excuses. It's a rare pleasure, and I have to be honest about it and confront my own hypocrisy with my eyes wide open.
Excellent. Loving that. So my final panelist is Carolyn. Carolyn, can you introduce yourself, please?
Yes, I'll try. I'm an architect who now seems to have turned into a food writer, except I'm not really a food writer. I write about the world as seen through the lens of food. And I've invented a word to describe this, which is sitopia, which is spelled with an S. And it's from the Greek word sitos for food and topos for place. And I guess I argue that we live in a sitopia. In other words, we live in a world shaped by food. But we don't realise the extent to which this is true. So obviously, after Christmas, we all look down and realise our trousers don't do up, you know, so that's the way in which we do realise it. But I mean, everything from our minds and our bodies to our habits, our society, politics, economics, cities, landscapes, I mean, you name it. has been shaped and is shaped by a climate, obviously, and indeed our relationship with nature leading to zoonotic pandemics. So food is basically an incredibly powerful way to see the world. And I guess I'm really passionate about sharing that idea, because I think all the great questions we need to ask and all the things we need to do can be approached through the lens of food.
Brilliant. And what is your personal relationship with food then?
Well, I mean, Ed's stolen all my best lines, but I mean, basically, not that I have lines, but I mean, it's a love affair. It's a passionate, involved, obsessive love affair. I actually thought the other day, I probably think about food more often than the average 15-year-old boy thinks about sex. You know, seriously. I mean, it's like every minute or so, you know, whether it's what I just ate, or what I'm going to eat next, or what I'm going to have for dinner, or indeed, you know, given the subject of this podcast, what I'm going to do with my leftovers. And I mean, it's just absolutely ongoing, obsessive, never ending. And one of the great sources of, well, the greatest source of joy in my life, probably, with just a few add-ons like, you know, sharing food with friends and so on. And good conversation, yeah. Obviously.
Mm. And what is your environmental confession?
Well, I mean, like your other guest today, I have plenty. I mean, I think you can't live in the Western world without basically having a sort of overriding sense of guilt, which obviously various organized religions make a lot of living out of promulgating. I would actually say my relationship with milk. I absolutely adore milk, good organic cow's milk. And I probably drink about 7 or 8 cups of tea a day, and I just want to have milk in them. I've tried oat milk. I really like oat milk, actually, but not in my tea, thank you very much. So that's probably my primary confession I care to share with you today.
A lot of milk. So wrapping that up now and moving on to some of our questions for our panel. So the core theme today is, are we throwing our planet away with our food? But before we go there, what's really interesting for me is to kind of think about what is the link between what we eat and what we don't eat and climate change? Something I've been passionate about, worked on for many years. And where does that link come? Because it feels very big, doesn't it? Food, as Carolyn said, is part of our society. And you can't separate that from the impact on the environment, can you?
No, and like I said, it's a very complex relationship. I mean, the key thing is everyone eats. I mean, unless you're a breatharian, we're all eating. It's a great unifier, and it's something which is sort of, you know, non-optional. And also, food is so inextricably intertwined with hospitality and socialising and connection, even if we're all only doing that by ourselves or with our families in lockdown.
Yeah.
But it's such an instrumental part of our lives. And clearly, the way that we eat and what we eat has, as Carolyn's already sort of highlighted, this kind of transformative effect on the world around us, both in terms of land use and all the embodied resources that go into different food products. So you can't talk about your own personal footprint and your own personal impact on the planet without touching on food. And indeed, when you look at work like people like Paul Hawken, who wrote Drawdown, looking at the top ways of tackling climate change, plant-based diets was one of the top 6. And so you can't take it seriously, actually, any kind of environmental stance or position without addressing diet.
Yeah. And Carolyn, I mean, you think about food in terms of the way we live in our cities and kind of how food surrounds us. I mean, does climate change come into your debate and thinking as well in terms of, if we're going to address climate change, what are we going to have to do in terms of that?
Yeah, massively. I mean, it's not just climate change, by the way. It's also mass extinction, which I think doesn't get enough press. Yeah. I mean, that's arguably an even bigger threat. So it's really our relationship with nature and with the planet in general is a massive part of what I write about. And I think, you know, really, for the food that we eat actually constitutes our future body. You know, we are literally made of all the meals we've eaten in our lives. And that came from a place that we choose to call the natural world, or a sort of, shall we say, a heavily modified form of it called the countryside. But, you know, ultimately, we have two fundamentally important relationships in our lives. One is with a thing we might choose to call nature, and that includes climate, and it includes all the other non-human living creatures on the planet. And the other is with our fellow humans, with whom we have to get on. And food sits absolutely at the nexus of those two sets of relationships. And you know, that's primarily what makes it so powerful as a medium for sort of thinking and acting around this stuff.
It's also worth noting, isn't it, that there's a sort of zoonosis factor here as well, that, you know, the pandemic that we're currently experiencing also comes from that ecological degradation pressure on an incursion into the natural world. And we're getting these viruses. There's a new virus which jumps species into humans about one every 4 months. So the more of that land use degradation, the more trade in endangered species often to be eaten, the more likely we are to get more pandemics.
Yeah, absolutely.
But Melissa, if you're talking to people practically about what they might be able to do, what is the first thing you talk about in terms of suggesting how people might eat more sustainably?
Well, there are, of course, so many ways that we can analyse, upgrade, cut back, open up the way we eat. And the first thing I say is, where do you struggle in the kitchen? And often it's people saying, I buy pre-packaged things because I'm not a confident chopper, or I don't have time to be a confident chopper. Yeah. So then we start talking about things like this. Another thing I say is, go and have a really good peek in your bin. You don't have to get your, you know, up to your elbows, but have a look in your bin. And then I start talking about having two bowls when you cook. One to put your veg scraps that you really, really think you can't do anything with, and then put something in that you're not sure about what to do with, and either take a picture and text it to me, or just read any of the million food waste saving books. And automatically, it always gets people that first meal, they'll text me and go, oh my gosh, the cauliflower stem, I literally habitually threw it in the bin. And now I've realised that the cauliflower stem I can grate up and turn into a fritter or into cauliflower rice. Whenever you look at your food, see it as meals. I find the most satisfaction when I've used up something, or when I see a rollover meal in sight, like, ah, you're going to be delicious for lunch tomorrow. I see spare chickpea. You are going to be roasted. You're going to be crunchy topping. So all parts of the ingredient. Yeah. It's delicious. Try not to think of them as second rate. Oh, the stem's the second best at the top. And I think it is Doug McMaster who says waste is a failure of our imagination. So I think having fun with it, and honestly, anyone that feels resistant, they have realized so quickly that the feeling of satisfaction, the feeling of not wasting money, and then you remind them that a third of food that's produced is wasted along the way, and a hell of a lot of it is happening in their bins, then they get it. Yeah. They get it.
And I must admit, you had me at cauliflower stalk. I love cauliflower stalks. They're so delicious. Why would anybody throw those away? And that takes me to kind of a place that, what is the biggest problem? Is it about what we eat or what we don't eat and throw away? How do we balance those two? Because obviously, Ed's confession of wanting to eat a steak. Steaks, we all know, have a pretty high carbon content. But actually, if we concentrated on not throwing food away, would that be a better way to address all of this?
Oh, well, I think if you've got the energy to think about both, then that's fantastic. Okay. I would probably say to anyone that, which I think we all do here, and I think anyone listening is keen to do the both, I would say probably start off with the most important, probably what you're throwing away, because you're consuming it. And I mean, as an example, I've spoken to two of the biggest supermarkets. I've cornered their marketing people and said, what about, let's use cauliflower as an example, what about next to the cauliflower section, why don't you use some sort of diagram and say there's three lovely parts of the cauliflower, the leaves, the head, the stalk, and give three great recipes that people can either scan on their phone or take a picture of. I don't know if they would do something like that. And then start asking the shop, your local shop, campaigning for a refill shop on your street like we've got. Or do you know about these refill shop trucks that are going around streets now?
No, tell us about those.
Brilliant. There's one called the Top Up Truck, which I think is a great idea. You know, the Olio app.
Yeah.
Look at the explosion of the Olio app, OLIO, based on one, connecting neighbours to each other, and in a COVID safe way, and two, stopping people from going without, and those that had extra passing it on, from toilet roll to food, you know, school meals at half terms and summer holidays. Could you make an extra lasagna and pass it on to someone else's kid down the road?
Yeah.
Brilliant.
It's also, there's something lovely about Olio as well, in the fact that it, you know, it removes the stigma of a food bank, as well as the efficiency, is that people love it because it feels like they're doing something positive and useful, rather than feeling like the end of a sort of charitable or philanthropic arm. And that's, so that's important in terms of people's self-esteem, I think.
Yeah.
I think something that really strikes me as we're all talking is that we clearly all cook all the time. You know, it's natural to us to sort of know how to put flavours together and basically had the skills to be able to be a confident shopper, shall we say. And for me, being in the kitchen is like playing. It's like the most sort of exciting, relaxing, creative thing I do. But I know that's basically because I do it every day and I've done it for 40 years. You know, by the way, I wasn't taught particularly by my parents to cook, because my mum hated cooking and hated having anyone in the kitchen. So it is, I am self-taught, but I just love food so much. And it's sort of, I look at a little bit of spinach in a little pot that I've saved over from a previous meal and I'm so excited to think what I can eat with this with, you know. So I think the really key to all of this is to give people the skills and the confidence to cook, you know, which is just not something that's endemic to our culture. And I mean, I know there's been a resurgence of it online and that's sharing ideas, which is brilliant. But I mean, there's so many people in this country still who just literally don't have the confidence to go, oh, I could put that with that and it'll taste yummy, you know.
Or it's sort of voyeuristic food pornography, isn't it? People, we watch hours and hours of cookery programs on TV and we read and buy cookery books, but we still don't cook.
Well, this is it. Cookery sales have been on the up even through the pandemic. The cookery shows are up. Apparently on one of the big streaming sites, there is a show called Best Leftovers Ever. And I think I probably get an email once a month about would I like to take part or in a pitch for a new leftover show. But they're not getting commissioned.
Yeah.
Or maybe they are. Maybe they're coming. But the other thing that I think is a shame is, could the bigger shows that do exist and have the audience hanging on their every word and, you know, some of the big shows, the next day all the supermarkets sell out of the ingredients that have been talked about, could they do some more food waste challenges? Could they show people, coming back to flavour, it is delicious. It doesn't feel like second best. It doesn't feel, going back to Ed's word about stigma, having the same thing every day doesn't have to be second best. Or show people how to change it up completely. So, you know, I do recipes where I'm like, I don't know, broccoli soup three ways, or maybe we should stop talking about cruciferous vegetables because that's enough to turn anyone off.
But, you know, a bit of celeriac.
Oh, no, people hate celeriac.
I love celeriac.
The book I wrote was based on the 13 most bought and thrown away ingredients. And it's the ones you can imagine. It's the chlorine washed bag salads with the plastic, the chlorine and just the bog offs and... So it's about those ingredients, showing people how to get excited about them.
And where does the most of our food waste come from?
I mean, the problem with our society is we've created the illusion of cheap food. Cheap food simply doesn't exist. It's an illusion. It's a collusion, you could say, between the food industries and politicians and society. Patrick Holden talks about this a lot. And indeed, I write about this in my latest tome. But if we internalise the true cost of food, then the only food that would cost the amount that it really costs is artisanal, organic, local, seasonal food, because that's the only food where the real cost of the food is already in the food, you know, and everything else is a lie. And we're paying for it with climate change and mass extinction and soil depletion and pollution and all the other things. So, I mean, for me, the problem we have to address is that we've created a society where the most valuable thing in our lives that we share and that we have to produce, we treat as if it's cheap. And to treat food as if it can be cheap is the equivalent of treating life as if it's cheap, because food actually, if you think about it, consists of living things that we nurture and kill so we can live. So to cheapen food is to cheapen life. And I mean, unless we address that, all this other stuff about bag salad or not bag salad is it's playing at the edges. So it's a structural fundamental problem.
I would totally agree, Caroline. I think one of the big epiphanies for me was when I started to see and imagine the embodied resources and the stuff that was being scraped into the compost bin. When, you know, where you're blithely throwing away that bagged salad or you're throwing away something and you're thinking it's not just about the missed opportunity of a good meal, as Melissa would recommend creatively. It's also just the fact it's the food miles, it's the fertilizers, it's the labor, it's the hydrocarbons, you know, it's everything, the human blood, sweat and toil that's gone into it. And when you're just there blithely scraping it into the compost, you're just like going, oh my God, you know, people have worked so hard to bring this to me and I'm just throwing it in the bin.
Yeah. I mean, it's very interesting. Historically, I mean, to waste food was seen as a sin. I mean, there's that very famous Hans Christian Andersen story about the girl who doesn't want to get her shoes dirty, so she steps on a piece of bread. And really, really awful things happen to her as a result of this, as indeed they should. I can't remember what they are. But she doesn't have a happy end. You know, we sort of live in a sort of slightly despiritualized age. We don't really think of sin as something that's an everyday phenomenon. But to me, to waste food and to not value food are the same things. And they're both sinful.
You're now taking me back to school where I was made to write 50 lines. To waste good food is not only detrimental to my health, but plainly idiotic.
And did it work, Ed?
That's a deep trauma.
Do you think?
Of course.
Do you think it worked? This is why you're now a food evangelist now.
Yeah, I think I was rejecting school dinner liver. So it was probably something pretty
challenging. School dinner swede, school dinner beetroot. I mean, that was sinful, actually.
Yeah. But just following on that, Carolyn, I think that's quite an interesting... I mean, is food and food waste really a first world problem, and about fairness? Do we have food waste all over the world, or is it because we're so prolific in our countries of this?
We really ought to have the guru of food waste, Tristram Stewart, on this program but I'm going to channel him anyway. I mean, his brilliant book, Waste, you know, in which he really sort of went into great detail on the food waste problem. I mean, what he noted, which was really interesting to me, was that the Global South and the Global North waste food for very, very different reasons. So what you're talking about, which is completely correct, which is that in the North we waste it because we don't value it, literally, and we vastly overproduce it. So, for example, in America, as Marion Nestle, you know, noted in her brilliant book, Food Politics, basically there is twice as much food produced every day for every man, woman and child in America than could be safely consumed. So literally, by definition, the amount produced is sort of 50% wasteful before you even begin. And of course, people then eat too much because it's around them and then they get fat. Yeah. And that's another form of waste, which we could also come on to. And of course, we don't value it and we waste what we don't value, which is the big takeaway. And of course, America, which is the most food wasteful nation on earth, they pay the least per capita for food of any country in the planet, and indeed any country in history. So that's the North.
Wow.
With the South, of course, it's completely different because they don't have the food infrastructure to keep the food fresh. So basically, a lot of it's to do with a pile of perfectly edible lettuces wilting on the side of the road because the chill chain isn't there, or the, you know, the sort of the logistics aren't there. And actually, of course, people in the Global South value food much more than we do. And of course, they spend a lot more of their income on it. So it's not a moral problem in the Global South. It's simply lack of infrastructure. But I mean, again, Tristram Stewart, you know, he argues that if we actually stop wasting, you know, about a third of it and distributed it properly, we could feed the whole world on the food that we already produce. So again, it sort of blows a hole in the whole idea that we have to produce more food to feed the world. We just have to waste less of it.
Yeah.
I think it's Tristram and Feedback, is it, Carolyn, whose tagline is Bellies, Not Bins? Is it that? That's their tagline.
Yeah, but he is utterly brilliant. And as I say, I'm channeling his essence now. For the benefit of us all.
That just brings me to a kind of, I guess one of the things we want to do in this programme is try and bring in another area of discussion. And we've touched on a lot of this, but this whole concept of food literacy, particularly coming back probably to the UK, I know that it's something like 25% of the UK cook from scratch less frequently than once a week. One in four can only cook three recipes and one in 10 can't cook at all. And Melissa, you started to kind of talk about whether we could tag it on the end of sort of programmes that are hugely popular already and sort of just start dripping it in. But how do we address this problem? Because you all talk so enthusiastically about food because you know how to cook, and cooking becomes part of the enjoyment of eating. How do we change this? Where do we start?
Well, Karen just reminded me, while we shout out people like Tristram, who is, yes, the food waste expert, also incredible people like Jack Munro, who has written many books, including ones based on tins and cans and canned food and frozen food, which I think is super important. And also something to just remind ourselves and reminds me as I'm preparing recipes to share, is people might have one cooking ring or a microwave to cook on. And, you know, there's me talking about roasting chickpeas, you know, might not have an oven, or it might not be at all worth efficiently wise, money wise, or an oven might not exist. There are so many fantastic community centres. I do a lot with the Felix Project, and not only do they rescue food that would otherwise go in the bin, and then they distribute it to people that need it the most. What they also do now, especially as in, they wanted to do it anyway, but it's been accelerated by the food emergency that was already happening and has been exacerbated by COVID, is to team up with, and this has been brilliant, they've teamed up with small businesses and restaurants and catering firms, you know, everyone that events catering, weddings that not happening and so on, to use the rescued food, turn it into really simple, delicious veg-packed meals, and then distribute it that way. So not just distributing raw ingredients, distributing ready-to-go meals. And some of them are taking it one step further and saying, if you enjoyed this, here's the recipe I used, you know, in case people want to have a go at it. Because once they've, when, you know what it's like when someone shows you, thinking about school dinner sweet and be true. If you've been put off of something for your whole life, but then someone cooks it for you, you'll be much more inspired to try it again. So I think these brilliant charities that have these practical arms, and then there's places like Chefs in Schools, where they literally put chefs in schools. There's the Hackney School of Food that's just opened last summer. They're growing veg, they're showing kids, and of course, by osmosis, their parents, really, what's involved in the growing and putting it together. There has to be so many more. My actual big old dream, which I have to stop calling a dream and call it a plan, because I've got to get on with it, is to have some sort of community space. I'm here in East London, where I can create a bit more of a cycle of food coming in, or growing food, feeding the community, having it as a place to learn, and just going back to the big media personalities, whether they're food or not. In a way, it might even be better if someone is not a food personality. What just about all the people, the big old celebrities that people listen to, love to see them cooking?
Yeah.
You know, maybe it doesn't need to be.
I think Marcus Rashford's not going to be allowed to go back to football at this rate, is he?
Brilliant Marcus Rashford, brilliant Reece James. Yeah, they're amazing. That's a great point.
We'll get him in, and I think, you know, we'd be cooking with hydrogen.
Maybe we should have cooking in football stadiums. They should turn them over to a cookathon.
Yeah, brilliant.
Brilliant.
I think so much of it is to do with confidence, isn't it? I mean, a lot of people just don't feel, they'll look at, as you said, a beetroot, or they'll look at something raw and just don't have the confidence to know what to do with it. And taking it to the energy world, I know I saw a brilliant community project where there were community workers who went door to door and chatted to people about their energy and what they could do to reduce their energy use. And people were much happier to talk to people they knew or knew that were from the community than an expert from outside. There was something about breaking down their barriers and giving people confidence to really start to move that. I mean, do you think we've lost some of the way of listening to generations past about, I mean, traditionally we would obviously have passed it down. Carolyn, you said your mother hated cooking. My mother hated cooking as well. And actually I learned how to cook when I was 14 because I hated her cooking too.
Luckily my father loved cooking. So actually he did teach me. And in fact, he taught my mum as well. So I should give him a shout out.
My mum taught me, but it was never a recipe involved. And so everyone's, you know, you cook things for people and you just become an instinctive cook. And people go, can I have the recipe? I was like, what recipe? I don't use recipes.
You just need to jot it down, darling, before you forget.
Yeah, well, I can't remember what I put in it. And it's different every time anyway. It keeps me on my toes.
No, exactly. But I mean, again, you know, this is, we keep talking, coming back to you, don't we? I mean, I was thinking about it earlier on, you know, when Melissa was saying, you know, we're like robots in the supermarket and we just reach for the same thing. But I mean, ironically, of course, that used to be part of a food culture, is that you were so attuned to what you did. You know, the classic granny in the kitchen is literally that she's made that same apple pie 6,000 times and it is automatic. And I mean, funnily enough, for me, you know, my ease in the kitchen is to do with having done it before. So if I've got friends over, I mean, I think I vaguely remember what that used to be like. You know, if I'm cooking something I cook a lot, I can chat to them while I'm doing it. But if I'm trying to puzzle out a new recipe, I can't. So I think it's okay for us to repeat this stuff, you know, and that's how you get the comfort with it. You know, what's so wonderful about watching, you know, old grannies rolling pasta if they're Italian, or making bread, whatever it is they're literally almost doing it automatically. And there's something that's a healthy food culture.
I love the pass it on piece that Melissa suggested as well, because my lockdown revelation was you can eat banana skins. And I, you know, I managed to get to the age of 48.
I didn't realise that. So that's a new one for me, Ed.
Yeah, you can take the ripe banana skin and chop it up and use it in a curry. And it's a bit like aubergine. And it was just like,
wow,
how did I never know that? And it's delicious.
Oh my God, you've revolutionized my life. That's so exciting.
Job done.
Yeah. And do you think, I mean, in terms of our relationship with food also, I mean, a lot of us now live in cities and the infrastructure around us means that we don't necessarily experience food being grown around us very much. But we are beginning to see things like, I mean, I chatted to the founder of the organisation called Growing Underground, where they're beginning to grow food in cities. I mean, is that the future of how we might see our infrastructure and actually maybe our food as well?
I mean, I've got quite a lot to say about this. So yes, I mean, I talk about a phenomenon I call the urban paradox. And the urban paradox is that we think of ourselves as living in cities, because, of course, physically, that's true. But if my food comes from Brazil, then you have to ask yourself, well, where do I really live? You know, do I live a little bit in Brazil as well? You know, so I think it's such a fundamental issue. And of course, historically, most cities, you know, most of the food would have, you know, of course, there would have been food coming in from a long way away. I mean, Rome is the classic example of that. But mostly a lot of it would have been coming in locally and also very visible. So we have to also remember that, you know, you used to have animals wandering around, live animals in the middle of the city, you know, because they walked themselves in and then they had to be slaughtered. So up until about a century ago, you would have known where your food was coming from, at least to some extent, living in a city. And we've gone through this profound change where food is this mysterious stuff that sort of comes in the middle of the night. Nobody knows where it's from. I mean, I remember going to Whole Foods in New York and being amazed because they're so obsessed with the food seeming like an immaculate conception that they actually have sliding doors at the back of the shelves so they can replace the food invisibly. You know, white gloved hand comes out and sticks in six more chicken breasts. So it's like, you know, oh my God, it really is kind of raining food from heaven. So of course we're completely divorced in the global north again, or the west, or whatever we want to call it, or industrialized nations from food. I mean, the urban paradox also tells you, by the way, that cities co-evolved with a place called countryside, and that is where the food has always come from. This is not to say food wasn't grown in cities. People kept pigs and chickens. I mean, I think it was you, Juliet, who said you keep chickens, which is fantastic. So we co-evolved with pigs and chickens because they're omnivores and they could eat our food scraps. Of course, we've now done away with this and we need to bring it back. That's something else that actually Tristram Stewart's also campaigning on. But to recognise that we can't feed the city from within itself. And by the way, I mean, the wonderful Growing Underground guys, they recognise that as well. But you can grow fruit and veg locally and you can maybe feed food scraps to pigs and chickens. But the rest is going to come from somewhere else anyway. So just to summarise, the really important thing, I believe, is that we have food growing in the city so that people can remember what it means to grow food. It's literally the involvement thing. So it's school kids growing food. It's just getting your hands dirty. The wonder of planting a seed. I mean, I actually grow food out on my roof. I live in central London, but I grow enormous Danish pickling cucumbers up a wall. But just the joy of seeing a tiny seed turning into a huge monstrous plant, you know, with fruit 2 kilos big that you can eat, is a magical thing. And so the important thing is to get people who live in cities to reconnect with what it takes to feed them. That for me is the key.
Yeah.
Just to grow something, isn't it? I mean, I remember there was a brilliant project in Brixton where I live called Brixton Brew, where they actually gave a whole bunch of people small hop rhizomes, you know, and encouraged everyone to grow the hops at home, whether it was in a window box, on a balcony, wherever they had. And then they harvested all the green hops on the same day and made a local beer, which everyone got a share of, and they had a huge party to celebrate. But for so many people involved in that project, it was the first time they'd grown anything in their lives. I mean, obviously, with the promise of a pint at the end of it, as an incentive. But I agree, Carolyn. I think, you know, whether it's tomatoes, whether it's herbs, whatever you can do, everyone's got a window. Everyone can grow something. And even that is a satisfying thing. If it's just the green chili you've just plucked off the plant that goes into your evening meal.
Absolutely.
So we can't grow it there, but we should grow it so that people can see it and remember it, really. And I guess, Melissa, that's what we've been talking about so much during the whole podcast today, is remembering what food is and remembering how we cook it and how we eat it. And that's really what you've been trying to do, is to remind people about what all these fantastic, like, cauliflower stalks are.
That's it. I mean, constantly reminding ourselves, we started by talking about nature. You know, we are all nature. We're not just part of nature. We are nature.
Yeah.
I can't help but smile when I think about how wonderful London could look if it was that bit greener. Mm. One of the many things, I mean, there's quite a few weddings that I didn't go to this year. I'm sure no one did. But do you know what I feel really upset about is that my foraging course in Marl End Graveyards got cancelled. Apparently Marl End, which is on the central line near me, is incredibly fertile. I wonder why. But it's the wealth of knowledge. So I am that person that until 3 years ago had no idea how to grow anything. But you're right. I think it was you, Ed, that started off by talking about not just wasting the spinach or not just wasting a bit of food, wasting all the resources that came along with it. As somebody who has, I'm excited about your enormous Danish cucumbers. And I want to know how enormous in a minute. I've tried to grow courgettes. My courgettes got a disease. It broke my heart. I was frantically researching. They take up a lot of space as well. But then at the same time, I was growing chard leaves and spinach, and my mum was, you know, coaching me over the phone. And she's saying, you know, the more you trim them, the more they grow. And up until about 2 months ago, they were still growing all my leaves. And that's fantastic. Leafy greens are the ones that come in spinach. So I sort of don't bother with things like onions and things you can buy loose and things that I can get in my lovely organic veg box that I feel lucky to be able to get and have done for 10 years. I grow the things that most, I think, are grown with plastic. But when they go wrong or when I forget to water them, or don't keep an eye on the bugs and the slugs, I'm furious. And I think all that energy's gone to waste and it's just me and a few courgettes. So yes, it does reignite something primal in us. And also it reminds us, my gosh, if I'm going to get that upset about the loss of one courgette, I'm going to make an effort to lose that.
But you can also do urban foraging, can't you? I mean, well, like one of the kind of the great inspirations I had in lockdown one was my mate Ollie from Shambhala Festival, who did a sort of, you know, collective cooking, and he did peas pottage, you know, like based on split peas, you know, traditional British crop being grown for centuries. It was our sort of dal equivalent before we started trading spices with the rest of the world. And he said, we're going to serve this for the Salsa Verde. And he goes, I just want you to go out from your house or your flat, wherever you are. And a lot of people on the call were in Bristol, but I was in Brixton. And I went out into the car park behind my block of flats, and I found dandelion, and I found sticky willy and some nettles, and you know, and we chopped it all up, and it went into this salsa verde for this peas porridge, and it was amazing. And it was like you're eating this and going, I mean, I don't know about the provenance of my particular pickings.
I mean, in a Brixton
car park, but I'm still here.
You washed it a lot.
Oh, yeah. No, it was definitely washed. But, you know, it was amazing. I said to my girlfriend, I said, I'm just going out to the backyard to look for some sticky willy.
And she said, wash it well.
Yeah.
Well, she was Italian and she was like, what are you talking about?
I'm not surprised.
You know what? You just reminded me, Ed, two great moments in the calendar where I saw people really having a good time is, you're right, when people round my way were finding wild garlic, stopping to chat to each other.
Brilliant.
And then, of course, blackberry picking.
Yeah.
How much fun was that?
Yeah.
I actually, you know, talk about trying to, you know, reuse things. I didn't reuse a used poo bag, but I realised that I could gather my blackberries in my clean poo bag, then get rid of them, and then use my poo bag to pick up the poo. Because I was caught short one day. I was like, how am I going to bring my blackberries home?
Yeah, that was my 3.5-year-old daughter's heartbreaking introduction to the notion of seasonality. Because, you know, she sort of experienced her first blackberry harvest, you know, as we were sort of picking them all the time. And then when they went, she was just like, where have the blackberries gone, Daddy? And you could just see her face like going, what do you mean? I've got to wait a year?
Year's a long time when you're that young.
I remember when you used to have to wait for the old potatoes to come back so you could have chips again. Sorry, I mean, that's just an age thing. You know, you used not to be able to get old flowery potatoes in the summer in this country. So my mum made, I mean, even though she hated it, she made the best roast potatoes on the planet. We used to call them crunches because they were so, they literally just exploded in your mouth, so delicious. But from kind of June to September, October, you just couldn't get them. And it was just, it was misery. So I mean, this is another thing about value. Sorry to get all kind of evangelical again, but, you know, actually not having something available 52 weeks a year is also part of the joy, the anticipation of when you can get it again. And I think, I mean, it's a huge part of what our 24/7 eternal summertime, as Joanna Blythman put it, existence has kind of taken away, and we need that back. That's part of the relish and the excitement.
It is. But also, I mean, I think lockdown's been interesting because this year we have an apple tree, and quite often we just don't get around to going picking all the apples. And we pick some of them, but a lot of them sit on the ground and eventually rot. This year, I was evangelical about picking them all, puring them all, and then freezing them. And even though it's a different time, Carolyn, I still think back to the time the tree had the apples on every time I open a packet of frozen apple puree. And it's delicious on breakfast. And it's quite interesting. It's very evocative. It brings you back to the effort almost that you put in at the time, not just the fruit.
I mean, that's a really key point, actually. Sorry, just to go on about this, why we're all so obsessed with getting people growing their own stuff. Is, as Ed said, when you put that work in, you love the plant like a daughter or a son, and it just changes your relationship with food. You can never not value it again because you understand, and you have this kind of primal. I'm in love with plants. I actually, just thinking about what a plant is actually moves me to tears. I know that sounds ridiculous, but these incredible creatures that are so intelligent and have learned to harness sunlight and make sugar out of it. I mean, it's miraculous. It's beautiful.
But Ed, kind of thinking about the future of food, where do you think this is taking us?
Well, I mean, there's going to be a bit of a bifurcation. I think there will be a whole bunch of what we might call the tech innovations around food, some of which are already with us, but are in their nascent stages of expansion, you know, from things like the Impossible Burger and all of these plant-based burgers and some of these lab-based innovations. I mean, the next big one coming through is going to be the precision fermentation of protein beyond just the corn-based things. And that has massive implications for the cattle and dairy industries, because actually bacteria and fungi have been making these proteins for a lot longer than cows. And they're sort of better at it if we can harness them. That said, I'm not a particular personal fan of the sort of Soylent or Huel nutrient shake. We've all established that we're quite gastronomic in this group.
Yeah, you and your
steak. But for me, that's a bit like artificial insemination. You know, it sort of gets the job done, but with none of the pleasure. And I think it comes back to what Carolyn was saying, and actually Melissa too. It's like, it's about relationship. And I worry that actually that increasingly industrialized and mechanized food production, whilst it will have a role, just further serves to sever the relationship with land and fecundity and the bounty of nature, which I think is absolutely fundamental to what it means to be a connected and conscious human being. And so for me, it's a balance. There will be some tech innovation which does create food very efficiently, which means that we can make sure that no one goes hungry. But at the same time, it's also about that sort of agroforestry and permaculture, which is going to require a lot more human input. And some places you'll see those two worlds intersect. I mean, I'm involved with a small robot company, for example, who are doing these small scale agricultural robots, which don't damage the soil, you know, looking at ways where we don't have to plow up fields the whole time and destroy all the microbial and mycelial and fungal relationships, which make soil the incredible community that it is,
yeah.
You know, and we treat it as a growth medium. And so without sort of hedging my bets, I think it's a quixotic mix of the two. There'll be some tech, but there'll also be some going back to the timeless ways of actually connecting and growing our food that we've always had. And I think, you know, we know that we can get more edible calories and nutrition from an acre of land which is under agroforestry than we can from an intensively farmed barren field like I've got out of my window just to the right of me here, you know, where they're growing sugar beet. I mean, why we're growing sugar beet these days, I still don't know. I mean, it's just a kind of, it's a nasty, nasty cash crop, but don't get me started on that one. So yeah, I like to sit on the middle. I mean, I don't think it's about popping protein pills and mineral pills in the future. I think we've all celebrated the joyous sensory satisfaction of eating and the importance of it connecting us to each other and to the natural world. And I think long may that stay the case.
Could I just say, I mean, you know, echoing literally everything Ez just said, but just then to reinforce the fact that the question of how to eat and the question of how to live are so closely connected, they're virtually the same question. And so what we're really talking about here is, what is a good life? That's the ultimate question we're asking. And I mean, I personally don't want to live in a world where Google owns and produces everything I eat, and I don't have a job because the robots have taken over. I know Ed's robots are nice robots, but you know, I mean, the question of what we're all going to be doing in the future and actually producing food when people value food is one of the great creators of good jobs on the planet. So as Ed said, we're going to need more farmers, not fewer. We're going to need more people to look after nature, not fewer. And we're going to have to pay more for food, which means we need wealth redistribution and land reform. But that's a whole other topic, probably. But anyway, I mean, ultimately, it's about, you know, the fact that we have to eat. So we may as well enjoy it and value it. And it's the heart of a good life.
Thank you, Carolyn. That was amazing. So when we look at the challenge around food waste, do we think the pressure should be on the individuals to be doing the work, the heavy lifting, or actually should it be a more systematic approach in terms of the way that we produce food? Where do you think the balance should be?
I am going to leap in here because I was talking earlier about the fact that we have a society in which we don't value food, and indeed our whole, all our politics and all our economics and even our idea of a good life is predicated around this thing called cheap food, which doesn't exist. Individuals can't change that on their own. I mean, we can do a huge amount, as Melissa's, you know, given us many examples, but we need the government to step in as well, because they have to stop externalizing the true costs of industrial food production, you know, and that's something that can only happen at kind of governmental international level. Basically, we need to move towards a kind of true cost accounting, polluter pays type food economy, which I happen to call a Sitopian food economy. In other words, an economy that values food. But, you know, you can call it what you like. Of course, there's huge amounts we can do as individuals, but it's an uphill battle. You're within a system, you know, and I often say it's much easier to eat well if you live within a sort of, you know, a good food culture, because it's all the sort of the easy wins are already there. You know, in this culture, it's a battle. So, you know, I think it's obviously got to be top down and bottom up. But, you know, for me, the missing ingredient is the government has to step in and take responsibility for food again. Nothing as big as we need is going to happen without that.
I totally agree. I think that's the problem, isn't it? Is that even I've heard government ministers say it's not the government's business to tell people what to eat. And you know, and actually is, because we could be radically influencing and inspiring people to eating better for a better world. So
yes to everything everyone said. And I also think that while lots of us have been eating more and more meals at home, and I think a lot more people will continue to have a bit more working from home, or we might have a few more lockdowns, I think that we need to be encouraged to take, I do this thing called hashtag laptop free lunch, you know, take a bit more of a ritual and a mental health break and an eye health screen break and build in. So employers should be making sure that there's a proper lunchtime cut off. And then thinking back to free school meals and Karen bringing up Marcus Rashford and Boris finally saying, yes, that 30 quid voucher we gave that big company doesn't look like it went very far. Half a red pepper, couple of baked beans and half a heel of bread. So I do think the government has to step in. And I was just thinking about what Karen said about being, you know, more farmers and more everything to do with food. You know, maybe there can be an arm of people that go around and help people waste less food. And they're like really fun, really engaged people. You know, I don't know, they're set up in the community halls. Like it should be a celebratory event. And a bit like you said, what did you call it? The punishment, pollutants pay. Maybe there's reward for those that use their food bill in the wisest way. That could be a cool thing too. Kids cooking food, maybe a little bit, you know, the teenagers cooking food for their parents when they come home, or, you know, I once sent my mum apparently with a lunchbox, you know, with like mackerel and a walnut, because that's what she'd force fed me, and she didn't like it very much in the end. But, you know, it's great. Let kids be involved in feeding their parents.
Yeah,
they could get them back for one day a week.
I love that. I absolutely love that. Now, just to round off, you've got 20 seconds each. Are we throwing our future away with our food, Ed?
Well, we are all environmental activists. Three times a day, every mouthful of food we eat shapes our world. We either eat for our future to create a healthier, happier people and planet, or we literally eat our future. So I think we need to use the power of our appetites wisely.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. Did you practice that?
It's the conclusion of my TED talk.
Oh, awesome. That was spot on. Brilliant. Carolyn, 20 seconds. Are we throwing our future away with our food?
Oh, well, I've got a clock staring at me now and I haven't rehearsed this. But anyway, just to answer, yes, we are. And the key reason is, and I can't repeat this enough. Food is the most valuable thing in our lives that we have to produce. It consists of living things that we nurture and kill so we can live. So if we don't value food, we don't value life. It's that simple.
Brilliant. I love that. A little bit over, but you started a bit late, so that's perfect. We'll let that. Melissa.
I'm stressing out. I don't know what to say that you two haven't just smashed already. Okay, I'll have a go. Oh, God. I'm sweating. Okay. To steal somebody else's line, Doug's, waste is a failure of our imagination. Let's put our plates first. Let's vote with our consumer power. And let's make sure we feed bellies, not bins. Stealing everyone else's line.
Love it, though. It sounded brilliant. Thank you so much, everybody. That was really interesting. I now know banana skins can go in my stews. I'm loving that. And thank you for all your insight and your inspiration. It's been brilliant.
Thank you.
Oh, so brilliant.
Thank you very much.
I enjoyed that so much.
Thank you so much for listening to Great Green Questions. If you like the show, then please rate and review and hit follow to never miss out on an episode. If you have a great green question of your own that you would like us to answer, please feel free to get in touch with me on Twitter at @DavenportJulia or Insta @Davenport.Juliet. Thank you very much for listening. See you next week.